die, Father, is nothing less. Ever since I was a child, I had a feeling that something is missing in me. I want to know why I'm here. Can any of us know that?
Become yourself. Then God and the devil don't matter.
I want to learn. I want to understand. Be careful. Can you find the force to enable these two quite opposite lives to live together in yourself? At any moment, the wolf can devour the lamb.
And you must learn what it means to become responsible.
This is an exact right. And that is why you are here.
Welcome to Everyone with Munchies for good ideas and interesting discussion. This is Henrik Palmgren and you are listening to the one and only Red Ice Radio with headquarters in Sweden, Scandinavia. That's in Northern Europe on planet Earth. We have a couple of different websites for you to check out. RedIceCreations.com, RedIceMembers.com, RedIceMobile.com and also Radio314.com. All are URLs where you can get to our material. Today we have three guests joining us for a special roundtable discussion on geomancy. Kurt Lindahl has been researching the spatial distribution of ancient and modern monuments for 5 years. John Cale runs the Cosmic Gnostic website and has released the book Mysterious Star Map of Charleston, South Carolina. And David Truman is a world traveler, historian and author. In the first hour, Kurt discusses the Priory of Sion and the Rite of Strict Observance. He'll relate to various sites as Shugborough Hall, Rennes Chateau, the Tower of the Winds, and the International Peace Garden. David Truman connects his work on how geomancy was used to establish different national identities. He'll discuss the Masonic overlay onto history, and John Cale relates more of the strong Masonic overtones that are existent in Charleston. All right. Welcome, gentlemen. Good to have you all with us here, of course. Thank you for taking the time from your busy schedule and getting together for this program. It's going to be really interesting. First of all, welcome back to Kurt Lindahl. You were with us most recently. Thank you for coming on back again.
Well, it's great to be here, Henrik. I appreciate it. And it's good to finally be here to speak with John and David as well.
Really good. John Cale, a few years ago now, since we talked about the Charleston star map, but I'm looking forward to revisiting this today, and of course, tying into our discussion and whatever kind of, I guess, new material and new insights you have about this. So welcome back again, John. How are you?
Hey, everybody. Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
Really good. And then lastly, we have Dave Truman joining us from Bolivia today. It was, of course, in 2007, I believe, that we had Dave last with us briefly. We talked about the conference he was putting together in Liverpool, Beyond Knowledge. Dave was part of that and was a really good turnout. Did a great job on that. So it's good to talk to you again, Dave. It was a while ago. What have you been up to?
Oh, quite a lot, really. I've sort of changed from being a sort of distributor of knowledge to a researcher, I suppose, in the last 4 or 5 years. So, been enjoying myself traveling around. A few ups and downs, though.
Bolivia at the moment, and you've written some articles for Quartz magazine as well. We'll want to get into some of this later on because it's a pretty interesting time. I think, well, let's begin with Quartz first. You have a lot of new material, Shugborough Hall mystery, the Rennes Chateau mystery. This is where some of the latest things that you're looking at, Quartz. Let's kind of begin there, I guess, and let's get things started here.
Okay, well, I'm really excited about that because it's very interesting, and all those places may indeed tie together through the same people that maybe were discussed in Henry Lincoln, Bangent and Lay's book, Holy Blood, Holy Grail in the Priory of Sion. And a lot of people, you know, don't believe that the Priory of Zion is a real group of people, and that's entirely possible because of the way that unfolded in the story with Pierre Plantard possibly being a con man. But he may have just recognized something that already existed and tried to use it to his own ends. Because what we see is a pattern of personalities such as Admiral Anson and his brother Thomas Anson of Shugborough Hall, along with Sir Francis Dashwood, who owned the West Wickham estate there near London, building a series of follies or whimsical pieces of architecture on their property that all had hidden meanings and attributes to it, and directional attributes, obviously, from what I study. So what we see is kind of a veneration of the Tower of the Winds in Athens, Greece, which was built in the 2nd century BC and was a very advanced timekeeping device and may have actually allowed the Greeks to fix longitude. And also, as we've discussed before, that activity would have all kinds of spiritual and talismanic overtones, as you know, we know that everything practical and religious was intermingled in those eras. So we have later in the 18th century these men all doing the tour of Europe and the Middle East as well, and either being told or prompted to go on kind of a path of enlightenment through Europe where they learned all the secrets of this architecture. And among that would be the directional attributes of the Tower of the Winds, which is an octagonal structure, and it does behave as an axis mundi. And the most interesting and compelling part about the Tower of the Winds is that the 315-degree azimuth created by this octagon leads straight to Avebury, right to the circle in Avebury. So. Yeah. It's kind of like they have two geodetic points on the earth that they were, you know, referencing together there. And, you know, my research did indicate that, you know, the Celtic culture did extend to Greece earlier in history, and awareness of this from traveler using the resources that were in England could have made them aware that this was there and to respect it somehow. And we see this later echoed because when the Ansons build their copy of the Tower of the Winds on the Shugborough estate, it's oriented such that it points an azimuth straight through the middle of Avebury and straight through the middle of Stonehenge, all in one line.
Hmm.
So this is a pretty amazing association of the Ansons paying respect to the, you know, the ancient megalithic culture in Britain. And also interesting, too, is the other two Tower of the Winds also behave as axis in England, one on Sir Francis Dashwood's estate, and the other one is at Mount Stewart near Belfast, Ireland. And that Tower of the Winds and the one in Shugborough are oriented to actually point the way to each other. So the one in Mount Stewart that was built later in 1800, we see the one in Shugborough being built in the mid-1700s, around 1750. The actual date of construction is debated. But it's really interesting that the Marquis of Londonderry opted to build his Tower of the Winds there in Belfast and orient it toward Shugborough as well.
So these guys are going on some kind of educational course, you think, that they're being taught the secrets of this kind of knowledge, and then they disseminate it and do it and build these kinds of replicas on their own properties and stuff like that.
Yes, if they have the means to. That's obviously part of the what goes on, you know, in being able to even build an array such as this. You're either a public entity, you know, a state, or very wealthy and can do it yourself. And that's why here in the modern world, we do see corporate interest and businesses creating arrays or campuses that they set up with statuary and arranged architecture and such. So that's really interesting that they seem to be referencing Avebury, which is, you know, the oldest culture in Britain. And a lot of, obviously, isn't known about it. Everybody knows that those structures have been there for so long, and nobody's really sure exactly which culture created them or not. So it's strange that, that, you know, Europeans or people in Greece would be referencing Avebury. But we all know that there's theories of trade that, that aren't exactly accepted by the mainstream that say this could be true. But what's also interesting about, obviously, Shugborough Hall is the Shepherd's Monument there. And there's been a lot said about that through the work of Lewis Buff Perry, who decoded the strange inscription on there. It's just a series of letters with dots between them. But he deciphered it and came up with the fact that the Stone of Destiny, or one of the Teraphim, or holy biblical stones, was hidden on the Shugborough estate. And all of the lore associated with the Shepherd's Monument says that the Shepherd's Monument will, quote, point the way to the Holy Grail. Now, using the techniques that I've used, I measured the angular orientation of the Shepherd's Monument itself, and the northwest azimuth led right to the International Peace Garden on the border of the United States and Canada, which is interesting because my theory to this point has been that that's a special axis of import in American history that was visited long before history says that was possible as well. And we have the octagonal powder magazine in Colonial Williamsburg, which is also seems to be referencing the Tower of the Winds as a reproduction, pointing the way right to the International Peace Garden. We have the Newport Tower in Newport, Rhode Island, pointing the way to the Kensington Runestone in a solstice event. And we have the octagon at the Peace Garden pointing to the Kensington Runestone. So, and also, you know, what Mr. Lewis Buff Perry was involved in was the Stone of Destiny, and he had identified a sandstone pillar very close to the border of the United States and Canada that had the Hebrew inscription of Preston written on it, and an alcove dug into the pillar where the stone used to be. So we have that on the same latitude as the International Peace Garden as well. And that's another way of geo-referencing things to a certain axis in addition to the arcs that are extended by the octagons. So it all seems to point to the International Peace Garden being of a place of importance. I mean, even Admiral Anson is involved in the tale of the stone that came from the sandstone pillar because he pirated it away from the French. On the way, they were bringing it back to France, and his squadron intercepted the Admiral Jean-Kier's fleet and captured the stone. And that's a strange story, too, because it smacks of being a setup, almost, that possibly both these men were Knights Templar or members of a pendant organization that had more concern with the safety of the stone than whoever possessed it. They might have had more allegiance to their group than nationality. And it's strange, too, because after the fleet was repaired, after Anson got the stone, the fleet went to France and was repaired and was getting to return to the West Indies when he intercepted the fleet again and captured a person known as the Marquis of St. George. And many people suspect that this individual was indeed St. Germain.
The real one, huh? The real deal.
The actual one. I've been looking into him a little bit, and he actually was a real person. He is not just a figment or a fairy tale. And there are have been some sources I'm trying to track down of Lady Anson actually speaking of Saint Germain in some of her correspondence. So here we have this Saint Germain too, is reported to have been the one that created the Order of Strict Observance, which I suspect is the group of people that are arranging these Tower of the Winds and these geographic associations in this era. I think they're using a technique that they learned from ancient times and from other alchemical sources and using it for their own ends to communicate and for intelligence purposes.
Tell us the order or the right of strict observance, what that is for those who don't know, Kurt.
Right. The right of strict observance was seemingly more oriented to France and Germany than in England, that we know, but we know there were secret connections between the Knights Templar too, irregardless of what nationality they were. And some of the sources say that Saint Germain actually created the order of strict observance, and this was an order of masonry that likely Alexander von Humboldt was a member of, and Thomas Jefferson was said to be a member of, and those are kind of sketchy sources, and I'm trying to track down better ones, and we know what a mystery it is with Thomas Jefferson, and his Masonic papers are missing, so... But the Order of Strict Observance may be what Admiral Hansen was a member of and may be actually associated with the Hellfire Club, the so-called Hellfire Club of Sir Francis Dashwood. May have been a kind of a cover for some of their activities. Hmm. And really, the Hellfire Club was not known as the Hellfire Club. There were several different Hellfire Clubs, but... Dashwood's group was called the Monks of Mendenham Abbey, and they actually met in an old Cistercian monastery near the West Wickham estate where Dashwood built all his follies there. And that's interesting, too, because the Cistercian order is associated with the creation of the Knights Templar.
Right. And again, I mean, these are the guys who were traveling out to different parts of the world, building up their towers, mapping a lot of, you know, places and following the salt lines and stuff like that. So if they had some kind of knowledge about, you know, countries previously unexplored or what have you, I think it would be within their order for sure.
Yes, definitely. They also, you know, we have the missing Templar fleet, and a lot of people suppose that this led to, you know, the legends of pirates, and a whole different, you know, possibly earlier intervention in North America. So it all fits in with what we see with the Kensington Runestone, which has a date of 1362, and possibly other places in the United States that are thought to be Native American sites, but were probably influenced by this group of people, like the Newark Earthworks in Ohio, which has an interesting feature there that's oriented towards the Great Pyramid of Giza at the same angle as the slope sides of the pyramid at 51.8 degrees.
Mm. Wow.
So, I have a video about that. It's a large circular feature with an octagonal feature connected to it via a small corridor, and the linear orientation of that points to the Great Pyramid.
And by the way, sorry to interrupt you, but I still have to mention this, because as you were talking about the right of strict observance, I think it's an important note to make that it's introduced basically by Baron Karl Gotthelf von Hund, a German, you know, nobility, aristocrat, whatever, a baron basically. And he's, of course, one who is very prominent in the actual Illuminati later on. He's brought in, he's believed to be you know, he's claimed to have a direct descendant from the Knights Templar and the Rosicrucians, and he joins the Order of the Illuminati pretty early on and is brought in by Weishaupt. So I think that's a pretty interesting note to make.
Yes, and coincidentally, it was an interesting story, because at one point he came forward because he felt he had been abandoned by the leaders of the strict observance. And a lot of people think they were connected with the Jacobite rebellion in England, because at about the same time he was abandoned, a lot of those people were either killed or arrested in the 1745 Jacobite rebellion in England.
Right. Yeah.
So, and that also, that the tie-in with the Priory of Zion with von Hund is interesting also, because the list he supplied of past Grand Masters matched the list that Pierre Pontard supplied for the Grand Masters of the Priory of Sion. So here we had the same man much earlier in history supplying a very similar list of people as being the Grand Master, past Grand Masters.
Hmm.
So Lincoln and in Holy Blood and Holy Grail, they made that connection as well.
Wow, cool.
Yeah, there's a link to Preston as well, because when the Jacobites marched south into England from Scotland with my Prince Charlie, they actually sacked Preston and took the city, well, what's nowadays a city, from the Hanoverians. And in fact, they almost actually got rid of the Hanoverians, which in my opinion would have been a good thing. But yeah, so there is another time with Preston there caught.
Yeah, exactly. And there we have, as I described before, the sandstone pillar that Perry found had the word Preston inscribed in Hebrew, and it's on the same latitude as the Peace Garden. And then if you go to the octagon at the International Peace Garden, it points a 45-degree angle right to Preston, England.
Wow.
So there's maybe a hidden clue there as well of these geographic associations where you go to point A, you know, to point B, back to point A, and you can find the way to the next clue. So that's kind of maybe one of the purposes of these arrays, too, is kind of like a vision quest that involves people figuring this out at a certain level of initiation.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Dave, any further comments on that?
I just find it interesting that the same themes keep coming up time and time again, because certainly with South America, for example, there is also a connection with the Knights Templar, in that when in 1307, when Philip IV and the Pope conspired to get rid of the Templar order, some of the fleet fled south into Portugal, and those Knights Templar were basically looked after by King Dinis I of Portugal. And he created the order of the Knights of Christ. And the Knights of Christ were seafarers, basically. And as soon as the Templars come, Knights of Christ arrived in Portugal within very few years, the Portuguese era of expansion and exploration began. And in fact, Dinis I's son, Alfonso IV of Portugal, became a Grand Master of the order. And what's also interesting is that certain family connections link in with all this, because at the time the Portuguese kings were of the sort of cadet branch of the House of Burgundy. And one of the founding members of the Knights Templar, sort of 200-300 years before, was a guy called André de Montbard, who was also of the same family. So, you know, all these things seem to tie in very much so.
Oh, indeed. And John, later I want to tie in Charleston, because certainly this is where the American branch, if you will, of this, all of this is set up. The American Scottish Rite is started in Charleston. I want to ask you more about the star map. If we keep for a moment a little bit more on your work, Dave, tell us about, you mentioned something interesting to us earlier about how geomancy is used to established nations. It has a deeper kind of meaning to it. Talk a little bit more about that.
Absolutely. Well, I can pick up on Scottish Rite Freemasonry, actually, because what I found was that I studied the sort of liberation wars during the, well, around the turn of the century, 18th to 19th centuries, between the emerging countries in South America, the republics, and the Spanish Empire, basically. And if you don't actually dig too deeply beneath the surface, you get this sort of impression that Freemasonry played a major role at the time, that all these liberators such as Juan San Martin or Bernardo O'Higgins, who was the first president of Chile, were Freemasons. But in fact, they weren't. What's interesting is that it seems as if there was a sort of rewriting of history about 40 or 50 years later, and Freemasonry became more important in the popular accounts of history that emerged after that time. Mm. So, I mean, it's quite fascinating to see how history has been remolded in some certain ways to emphasize the role of Freemasonry.
Why do you think they did this, Dave? Why does this happen?
Sorry?
Why do you think they did this? They want to seem more important than they actually are? Why did they do this, do you think?
Well, I think it was about the establishment of a national identity in these new countries. Take the example of Uruguay, for example. The popular myth of the foundation of Uruguay is that it was founded by 33, Orientals who basically fought off the Portuguese stroke Brazilians in the land to the east of the Uruguay River to establish this new country. In fact, the real history is nothing like that at all. What happened was that it was a very fluid situation in what's now Argentina and Uruguay at the time. And basically, Uruguay was always a sort of area of struggle between the Portuguese Brazilians and the Spanish-speaking people. And it was very unstable politically. And Britain was basically importing most of its beef from there during that period. We're talking about the 1840s, 50s, whatever. And Britain decided that it had had enough of all these skirmishes and fightings and it wanted something more stable. So it created something called the Treaty of Montevideo, which created the state of Uruguay. But the popular myth is that these 33 people came in patriotically, fought off the Brazilians, and created the country. But nothing like that really happened. In reality, there were these people, but there weren't 33 of them. And they weren't Orientals in the sense that they came from the land to the east of the Uruguay River. Some of them were from what's now Paraguay and Argentina and what have you. But this was sort of superimposed on the real history to give a sort of Masonic overlay to everything.
Interesting.
So the number 33, Oriental. They're both prominent aspects of Scottish Rite Freemasonry.
Sure.
Not only that, but when you look at the sort of geomantical aspects of this, I first came to Uruguay last year, and I discovered that there was a town called 33, which means 33 in Spanish. So I thought I'd go there, curiosity, because I thought there might be a Masonic connection with it. When I got there, I found that it's a small town, provincial capital in the northeast of Uruguay. It's got this huge obelisk dominating the whole town. It was built in about the 1950s and made of concrete. And then I discovered that this town, 33, actually lies on the 33rd parallel south of the equator. It even has a postcode, which is 33,000. It's as if everything's been done to establish the identity of Uruguay and these 33 Orientals, so-called, in terms of Scottish Rite Freemasonry and the national identity of Uruguay. Also, obelisks seem to be put in places that are to do with the birth of new nations. In Chile, there's a suburb of Santiago called Maipú. And Maipú actually is also on the 33rd parallel. And it was the scene of the battle that created the Chilean nation when San Martin basically defeated the Spanish. And there's a huge obelisk there as well. So, you know, it's quite strange the way all this happens. But it's as if this sort of Scottish Rite Freemasonry overlay on the real history that actually took place to impress on the psyche of the nation that Masonry plays an important part in their identity.
Isn't that interesting? They're kind of perpetuating a myth and to making it seem that they're more important in hindsight. John, let's tie in Charleston in this as well. We want to hear a little bit about the star map and kind of where you're coming from in all of this as well.
Well, there's many things I could comment on that was said. As far as the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, I would definitely agree with that notion. But as far as Charleston goes, it seems that there were many different groups and not just the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. However, it seemed like amongst these groups that are out there, they're all in kind of a competition amongst themselves because it was a popular thing to be living, I guess you could say. So you see it everywhere, coming from different variations of Freemasonry. And I just find it interesting that the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry was probably the later group that started claiming all this other Freemasonic history. But what I have found, in going back to the park, I revisited one of the parks that's associated with the star Cursa, and it is the only park that is in the star map that is of an octagonal shape. when you're looking above it. And I found that this particular park itself was really interesting because it's also, it has, well, there's many things to talk about this particular park. First of all, it has a Washington Monument, which is a very tall obelisk that stands in the middle of the park. And then around the sides of the park are commemorations to various people. All throughout the park, or the parks of Charleston, there isn't very much at all when it comes to the Templar Knights. As far as symbolism goes, you don't really see too much referring to the Templar Knights, except for one monument that I found that is in this particular park, the Octagonal Park, the park that holds the Washington Monument. It is a statue that, or an, it's a sort of Masonic structure that is giving honor to a man named Francis Salvador. And on it, it says Francis Salvador, 1747 to 1776. And he was the first Jew in South Carolina to hold public office and to die for American independence. And above his name is a Templar Knight holding a wand in his right hand, and he was holding a skull in his left hand, and there's a man on his knee that is obviously being knighted by this Templar Knight. So I just wanted to throw that in there. I thought that was kind of interesting because I haven't seen any Templar Knight associations as far as the artwork that still exists in these parks, except this one location.
Huh. Interesting. Now, can you give us the basic outline of the Charleston star map, John, and then later we can talk about if Charleston was built basically on an ancient astrological, astro-theological premise, or if this was kind of superimposed onto the city later on, whatever you think there. But give us the basic outline again of the star map.
Well, I started to take my lunch breaks when I was working around the area, and every time I would go to somewhere to take a lunch, it happened to be a park that was downtown Charleston. And so every time I went to a park, I pinned it on Google Earth, and after a while, it started to present a picture to me because I was aware of the other alignments of various structures around the world. And so I started to think, maybe there's something behind these parks in Charleston. And essentially, I started to think, Orion, the constellation of Orion, was the first place to start with this because it's so common around the world. And but I found that the stars weren't matching up with their meaning unless I flipped everything upside down. And then when I began to do that, all the stars in all of the parks in Charleston match up with meaning that are one and the same. I'll give you an example. This is probably the most obvious one. It's in a park called The Battery that is right downtown Charleston. And there's a statue there that's the main focus of the park. And the statue itself is a goddess. And the goddess is obviously Minerva because Minerva has a particular pendulum that she wears around her neck that looks like Medusa. If you look in old images of her, you'll see the similarities. And so we have Minerva, who is a goddess of war, and we have Bellatrix, the star, which has been associated with as being a goddess of war as well. And so basically all the locations that are major areas of downtown Charleston, which are major parks, commemorating various wars throughout history. They all are part of this part of the star system that matches up pretty well.
Yeah, it does.
And so I've been studying this.
Now, how far back do we need to go to when this actually was completed? Then, if we look at all the components that make up the representation of the stars, if you will, because one of my contention was, wait a minute, I wonder if, because we know that ancient cities are based on principles, in some cases, on stars, where they are positioned. They want to have certain streets actually in alignment and etc. And I was thinking, I wonder if the same thing was with Charleston, if it was like that from the beginning, from the get-go. If not, obviously they would have to had they chose the areas and the locations where to place these monuments at a much later date. Is that what happened, John?
Well, there has been a history of many battles and wars. It's just a bloody history in Charleston. It's been burnt down. And to me, like I see that they've been rebuilding over the same areas over various periods of time. And I would say that whenever something fell down, they went and built something on top of it and have just kept these areas alive ever since. But there are newer parks in the area that are, you know, that were built within the past 30 years or so. But they've just been modernized, and though the same emphasis in these areas have been tried to, you know, they try to keep the same though. But I do see that like things have been destroyed and then built again, and then destroyed and built again.
Right.
But I have a feeling that it even goes way further than the colonization of these people. I think it. Actually, I've been trying to get into more research into this, but I have a feeling that a lot of these places were Native American sacred places that goes back thousands of years. Right now, I'm just trying to keep digging, and there's just more and more to dig in around. You know, you have everything from the times of slavery to the times of the pirates that were here in Charleston. So it's really hard to know when and who built everything, because so many people are behind it all.
Exactly. Now, Court, let's go back to you again and tie this in, because you talked about Anson before, and he has an interesting connection to Charleston as well. Tell us about that.
Yes, Admiral Anson, at the time when he was a captain, I believe it was in the 1724 to 1735, he actually lived in Charleston, and a part of Charleston was named Ansonboro for Captain Anson, as he had won that property in a poker game from Gadsden, who later was one of the bigger statesman of South Carolina and a famous South Carolinian. And it's interesting, as John was saying before, that John told me too, that when the Scottish Rite was founded, it was founded in the Shepherd's Tavern. If I'm right, John, is that correct?
Yep.
And that may be
correct.
A small tie into the Shepherd's Monument, or that value of that representation of Christ by Admiral Anson. Possibly, and I have read some accounts also. We were discussing the Order of Strict Observance earlier, that might have morphed into the Scottish Rite in part, because what I read about the Scottish Rite, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, John, was that establishment in Charleston was international. I think that was the first Scottish Rite founding ever. Like, even the French and Scottish Rite in Scotland actually refers to the Scottish Rite in the United States. I think,
yes,
that's what
there's
I
a monument.
Yeah,
the monument that's downtown says, "On this site stood Shepherd's Tavern, the birthplace of the ancient and accepted Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, the Mother Supreme Council of the World, May 3rd, 1801. And then it has a list of all the founders.
Yeah, that's a little known fact. I think most people, obviously, because the name, assume that it's associated with Scotland mostly, or France. When you really look into the Scottish Rite, a lot of their ethos and philosophy developed in France, and then with the Normans that left France and went to Scotland and England, then it became part of it there until it was actually established in South Carolina. So that's very interesting too. And also, you know, part of the things I've been learning too about the Scottish Rite are the Kabbalistic overtones of the Scottish Rite. You know, you have Albert Pike writing that is one of the main tenets of Masonry. And this leads me back to, again, of all places, to Rennes-le-Château in France. Because just recently, I've been learning about Girona, Spain, which is one of the earliest schools of the Kabbalah in Europe. And the way the Kabbalah developed, the European version assumed some of the mythology and lore and alchemical practices that were already in Europe as well. So that's an interesting tie-in as well. And I was looking at Rennes-le-Château as an axis because there is an octagonal feature in the chapel, which isn't standard in every Catholic church. And there's another similar octagonal feature in Rosslyn Chapel in Scotland. So I examined Rennes-le-Château as an axis, and it did seem to define many of the places. The building there is oriented at 87 degrees, so I created my axis based on that. And one of the main rays coming off of that matched the pentagram that Henry Lincoln had delineated in the Rennes-le-Château area using features years ago. And that was really interesting because first I drew the octagonal templum and turned it off, and then I drew the star, and as soon as I, you know, brought the templum back up, it matched the star right away. So that was really interesting there when that happened. But as I studied, I began to find out the work of a woman named Patrice Chaplin, who as a youth had spent time in Girona, Spain. And she says that she witnessed things that indicated that the Father Saunier from Rennes-le-Château, who was the first one to expose the mystery there, and the Catholic priest who came into a lot of money, and he later built Follies at Rennes-le-Château, just like Anson and Dashwood had earlier in England. So it seems like this group of people is expressing themselves through these kind of whimsical forms of architecture. And we had Father Saunier building the Tor Magdala, which is a miniature tower, kind of a really neat little feature there, and the Villa Bethania. And both of those features are located on rays coming from the axis there at the chapel as well. And the Chateau Hot Pool, two of the towers there, which is a famous feature of Rennes-le-Château, match the axis as well. So when I began to look at the work of Patrice Chaplin, who said that there was a group of people, including Father Saunier, that would do rituals that were actually aimed at Rennes-le-Château, as if that was kind of the mecca of their faith. And in addition to this, in Girona, there's a cathedral with an octagonal feature. And right behind this was another tower called the Tor Magdala that even resembles the one that was later built at Rennes-le-Château. And this is where this woman claims to have seen the rituals occurring. And she even claims to have seen Jean Cocteau there, one of the supposed grand masters of the Priory of Zion. Now, whether this story is true or not, it's still, we see this mythology being built to this place, you know, in Spain that Rennes-le-Château points to. So then I began to examine the Girona Cathedral with its octagonal bell tower that was built in about 1590 for its directional attributes. And interestingly enough, first of all, it points to the International Peace Garden. Just like the Shepherd's Monument that the Ansons built at Shugborough, and just like the Powder Magazine in Colonial Williamsburg, and likely Thomas Jefferson's octagonal state poplar forest as well. So when I came upon this information about Girona, I was just startled to see that it was could be associated with the International Peace Guard. Now, not only that, one of the other northwesterly azimuths coming from that octagon, not only does it go through the pentagram that Henry Lincoln delineated, it goes right through Renly Ban, which is another famous site associated with the Renly Chateau mystery and the home of the Catholic priest that was thought to actually have masterminded the entire scheme, if you will. But as this line continues, the same azimuth there that goes through the star, it extends to England. And earlier I had identified Avebury as a hexagonal axis that intersected with a place called Abbotsbury on the south coast of England, which is a kind of a hill with a church on top of it, very similar to Glastonbury. So not only does Avebury point to Abbotsbury, but also the Girona Cathedral points there. And as the line continues, it intersects directly with Borough Mump, another famous site on the Michael Line. And my model of Avebury also included the Michael Line being one of the hexagonal rays coming from Avebury, and it transects over Glastonbury Tor precisely and Borough Mump precisely. So here we have this templum I identified in Girona, a city with lore associated with Rennes-le-Château, and it intersects with two famous sites of antiquity in Britain that are part of the other templum. And so, and like again, Avebury is associated with the Tower of the Wind, so we see everything being associated with Avebury. I mean, there's even a building that was built recently, and it was even featured in the opening ceremonies of the Olympic Games, called the Coq d'Argent, the poultry building in the city of London that has a unique arrow-like pointing feature when viewed from plan view. And this building is odd in that it's famous for people committing suicide there.
Really?
And it's very near. It's only about 300 meters from the center stone of London, this building. And this arrow-like array that's part of the building points the way right to Avebury as well.
It has a the poultry building, that it has a very kind of strange almost, I don't know how to explain it. It looks like an ancient planet. Also, architecturally, it's kind of reminiscent of actually the MI6 building in London as well, with these kind of terraces. It has a kind of like almost a Babylonian feature to it.
Yes, the front there, then the lawn in the opening ceremonies, the part where the Queen was flying up the Thames there, they passed over that building. And there were some people in the front waving and everything. And we all know the symbology in the opening ceremony was interesting with 007 coming to the Buckingham Palace to get the Queen. And we all know that Dr. John Dee, who was associated with Queen Elizabeth I, his code name was 007.
That's right.
They were giving us a little nod there with James Bond coming to parachute into the Olympics with the Queen.
Good stuff.
Which was interesting. I thought that was very funny, and the Queen was a good sport to do that.
Yeah, it was pretty... Yeah, I guess a lot of people were amazed that she actually managed to, to pull that off, or to agree to do it, rather.
But yes,
there
yes.
We go.
But there was another interesting reference to Avebury. That's what really the whole system in Europe during the era I'm speaking of now, the Anson era, after that with the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood, which is during the 19th century, that kind of filled the same bill that Dashwood and the Dilettante Society filled. And this is like groups of artists and, free thinkers and things like that, that kind of use a Masonic framework or maybe associated with the Masons or some group of their own, sort of like the Bohemian Club in San Francisco, where they choose to communicate with each other and build these follies and that have geographical and symbolic meaning to them. So there's a big connection to the Kabbalah, I'm thinking, through the Girona connection there with Rennes-le-Château. It seems to all be finally coming together, where we see these different groups of Knights Templar that may have once been mistaken for the Priory of Sion, and how they developed in France and Britain in kind of a separate way.
Let's see if we can talk a little bit about some of the articles that you wrote for Quartz Magazine. Maybe you can just tell us about some of the work you've done there. You have some interesting kind of focus basically on Andean Cosmovision, the kind of the Incan geomancy, if you will. Tell us about this, Dave.
Yeah, I mean, basically, what I wrote in the article that Quartz already published was really looking at how the skies, the land, if you like, and the human world all interlinked. And I think it reached a sort of zenith with the Inca, because they were really drawing on more ancient traditions coming from the Tiwanaku culture, and I think much, much earlier than that as well, going back, you know, maybe up to 10, 12,000 years BC, in my personal opinion. And what they did was they took certain traditional practices and developed them into a very sophisticated vision of the world in terms of time, in terms of alignments, and everything else. For example, in lots of South American cultures prior to the Incas, there were sacred sites that people went to venerate them, and they were lined up in straight lines. These sacred sites or sacred places were called huacas, generally, and they were joined by sesques. Now, when the Incas actually founded Cusco, or perhaps refounded it, let's say, but certainly founded it, they basically used the Coricancha, which became known in later Inca times as the Temple of the Sun, as the center point of their whole, I won't say empire, because I don't think it was an empire. They called it the Tahuantinsuyo, which means the four parts together, the north, the south, the east, and the west. And every tribe that they conquered, if you like, really had the choice of joining them or fighting them. And if they joined them, they were given an ancestral alignment along one of these sesques with their own sacred places along it. And these often lined up with rising points of certain stars and constellations. But everything met in the Tahuantinsuyo, in the center of Cusco. And each tribe had its own priests who were responsible for looking after the huacas or sacred sites on these straight alignments during certain times of the year. And there were probably about 40 or 42 of these alignments and some 328 sort of official sacred sites. But it was a very inclusive system. It was a system that actually really gave a unity to the whole of the Inca Empire. And one of the things that has struck me since I've been studying how this came to collapse with the coming of the Spaniards and the conquistadors, is that the role played by geomancy in all this was actually very important. Because, I mean, certainly the Spaniards, there were very few Spaniards in the party. I think there was about 200 in Pizarro's party when he arrived in what's now Peru. And so to overcome this vast empire of, you know, thousands and thousands, even though they had guns and horses and things like that, was quite staggering. And okay, smallpox, which they inadvertently introduced into South America, played a part. But another big part was the destruction of this vast geomantic empire that the Incas had developed. Because what happened was that the Jesuits played a very important role in this, funnily enough.
Sure.
They had the job on behalf of the See of Rome of doing something called extirpating these traditional sites. So basically they had a manual, which was called the Extirpation Manual. And they used to have a strict methodology of going to these sacred huacas and destroying them. So the indigenous people, the people of the Inca realm, basically hid all of their sacred symbols and sites away from the Jesuits to try and destroy them. But I'm increasingly coming to the opinion that what really happened was that the Jesuits knew the sort of geomantic power of these things in terms of holding a sort of identity together. And it was really part of a deliberate strategy to disrupt and destroy this in order that the social fabric of the Inca realm fell apart. I think this is probably something that's been not really looked at very much in terms of the historical record. Because it's no coincidence either that, of course, the Spanish built their churches on many of these sacred sites. And they align now in a similar way to in Europe where, certainly in Britain anyway, churches were built on megalithic sites, for example. And you see alignments like the Michael line and the Mary line in England and so on. Very similar things happened in South America, in what's now Peru, Bolivia, etc. And you can follow these alignments from the churches. And one of the things that Court and I did discover in the last couple of weeks, actually, was that on the site of the Coricancha in Cusco, the Spanish built a Dominican convent monastery. And the tower of that monastery is actually an octagonal tower, the bell tower, which, unfortunately, I was going to send Court some pictures of it when I was there last week, but I can't now because I haven't got them. But you find octagonal alignments all over South America with the colonial buildings and so on, and particularly sometimes with sort of central squares, Plaza de Armas or town squares, where you'll get a fountain and you will get an octagonal font around the fountain, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
And these very often line up with these ancient alignments that predate the Spanish. So that's a very interesting feature where another culture comes along and sort of builds on top of the previous culture to impose a new social order, etc.
Yeah, it's a very brutal force of doing it. It's sending the message clear, far and wide, of course. But do you think that it could be that the sites that they build on then basically has... Well, if we look at it from this point of view, that many of the sites that you've been talking about, Court, so far... they might all, to a certain extent, be built on a more ancient, older grid work in some way. And they're basically now trying to reassess this or reaffirm it or strengthen it further. There's tons of different theories about this. But, I mean, we could tie into the picture here the kind of the grid of the gods theory of Joseph Farrell, if you will, that it's a kind of a grid that is there to... not work in human favor, let's say, and it's being strengthened by these ancient orders and occult societies. Dave, any comments on that?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, funnily enough, going back to the town of Trentri Tres, 33 in Uruguay, and the huge concrete obelisk there, if you actually look at it, it's not a true obelisk in the sense that it's actually a pyramid. And I read Joseph Farrell's book, The Grid of the Gods, quite recently, and he mentions that there are different kinds of pyramids. And one type of pyramid he identifies, based on the work of a certain Ukrainian physicist who developed a theory called deep physics, is called the Sharp Pyramid. And I'm just trying to think of the name of the physicist now, but it's quite unpronounceable. But basically, he had this idea, and it's similar to hyperdimensional physics. He called it deep physics, this Ukrainian physicist, where a sharp pyramid is basically one that has very long sides and is very tall, and it comes to a point, obviously, very high up. This is just like this particular pyramid or obelisk in Trentri Tres. And it's a sort of arrangement whereby it amplifies or radiates, if you like, sub-material perturbations in time-space, and is a way of actually producing sub-quantum particles out of the ether, if you like. And I thought that was quite interesting, because it's almost as if it's a kind of parallel to an alchemical idea. Of the sort of rebirth or creation out of something out of nothing, and this is all to do with the idea of the phoenix, the alchemical phoenix as well,
yeah.
which is itself associated with obelisks, and that's another theme that recurs through many of these places, where in the new South American republics they are actually giving birth to new countries out of the decay of the Spanish Empire. So again, it's this layer upon layer that's occurring.
Interesting, yeah. Kurt, what do you make of some of the ideas of the grid of the gods, if you're familiar with the work?
Yes, I'm somewhat familiar, and it's very interesting. And what David is seeing there in South America is really interesting, because it seems to echo what's going on in Europe. And we have all of these researchers supposing that there was some sort of pre-Columbian contact, but it, you know, if you see this, you wonder if they didn't come to Peru and see this happening there and take it back to Europe. And we do see the Michael line itself as it extends across the globe to Lake Titicaca, that, you know, there may be some sort of symbolic geographic connection there. And when we go to Tiwanaku there, some of the artwork and imagery there with the sunken gardens they have there with all the different kinds of heads there from different ethnicities from around the world, seemingly, you can start to envision a scenario where this was somewhere where people from all over the world may have met somehow, and then taken these concepts back to where they were from, possibly, or they could have developed in Britain and been brought there as well. If not, just developing separately at each place, but the way the axes work, and we do see at the Coracancha, it works just like one of the axes I've identified in Europe. We have the Coracancha and Tiwanaku are both oriented to be about 1 degree west of true north, so they're both 1 degree off of what it is now, what the rotational axis of the Earth is now, and that is interesting. So we have the Coracancha pointing a line directly to Tiwanaku, to the ruins itself, and then right there at Tiwanaku, Pumapunku is just to the southwest. It is a large square-shaped area, and diagonally that points right to Tiwanaku and even matches the diagonal aspect of the step pyramid at Tiwanaku. And then in more modern times, and this may speak to the more modern architecture that David's been telling us about there, they have the museum there at Tiwanaku that is situated just between the two sites on this line that connects them both. And the building from plan view is kind of shaped like the Incan axis or the Chicana shape, which forms an octagon. And the new modern museum is oriented so one of the facets of that matches the line coming from Pumapunku to Tiwanaku. So right there we see the old and the new being mixed together. And it's going to be interesting here in the future to see how a lot of these sites that David is talking about line up with each other and possibly with the Coracancha or other places as well, and to see if the modern Masonic axes are referencing the ancient sites as well or pointing to some of them out of respect.
John, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about Charleston as a vortex of supernatural energy, and this could kind of play into what we talked about here by some kind of grid work that the city is a node point, if you will, of an ancient megalithic grid, and this is causing, I don't know, certain effects. I remember reading a while back on your website, you talked about there being a lot of supernatural activity in Charleston. You also wrote that there actually was a ritual conducted there to bring Osiris or Lucifer into the world. Tell us about that.
Yes, Charleston's very supernatural. It's well known for its ghosts. And as I was growing up around here, I'd always been aware of the ghost issue. But to find out, to get into the subjects of the occult, all the occult aspects of Charleston in itself, you find there's probably a good reason why. And there is Sirhan's attorney, Day Williams, once said that if a life is taken close to the 33rd parallel, this fits with Masons' demonic mythology in which they demonstrate their worldly powers by spilling human blood at a predetermined locale. And, I think about that. I think about how Charleston is well known for its ghost tours. You can come here, and there's many different kinds of tours, but the ones that are most popular are always surrounded by the supernatural aspects of Charleston. And yeah, there was a ritual that happened long ago that Malachi Brendan Martin wrote about that ultimately got him killed. But he wrote about how there was a ritual that was called the enthronement of the fallen archangel Lucifer. And it went hand in hand with a ritual that was being conducted in Rome at the same time.
Really?
And supposedly this was conducted over the phone in Charleston while there was a Luciferian or Masonic, or I don't know what label you want to put on it, was being conducted here in Charleston at the same time over the phone in order to generate that power that was being generated in Rome. And there's just so many things about this place. There's a lot of, like I was saying earlier, Charleston is known for its wars, its death and misery, everything from the Native Americans here that were basically killed off, and you know, of course, there's the pirate history here. This was a major pirate location.
Yeah.
And then you know of American Revolutionary War and the Civil War, and of course there's slavery that, you know, everybody knows about. And it seems like this area has always drawn a sort of supernatural harnessing of spirits here that can't seem to get out. And so I've been wondering if there is a connection between these structures. Maybe there's something here that's a lot older than the Masons or, you know, the colonizers.
Right.
There's just a lot of buried history here that it's really hard to know where to dig because there's so much of it. But it's definitely a supernatural place. And I know that this is a popular place for ghost hunting, for instance. And so you got to wonder why is that? Why is one area more supernatural than other areas? And it just feels like there's a sort of connection between that and the star map. Maybe it's you know, keeping these souls trapped in this area. There's all kinds of speculation that could be made in that regard.
There's the Osirian underworld, in a certain extent, that's being emanated from it. And again, it's all taking place right there on the 33rd parallel as well, John, and that could have something to do with it as well.
Well, you mentioned Osirian, and yeah, it does, because one of the last locations in the star map is where the dead reside in Charleston. And it is a cemetery called Magnolia Cemetery. And this is where the star Sirius would be located, which is the dog star. And when we think of the dog star and the gods of Egypt, you can think of Anubis, who was also a dog-headed god. He was associated with the dead. And in this location, it is just filled with Masons who have been buried in this location. And their stone heads are obelisks. And there's a very large pyramid that is at the center of this cemetery. So when I look around Charleston's parks, it's interesting because during the day, you'll see children playing in all these parks. There's a main area called Waterfront Park where it holds three of the so-called stars of the Belt of Orion that I'm associating it with. And this area, it tends to get a lot of the children to come and play in these water parks. And so during the day, we have a lot of this harnessing of youth energy because the other parks are also quite popularized by the college kids that are in the area as well. So during the day, you have all this youth walking around. And then at night, you have all this, you know, supernatural kind of energy going around.
Really interesting. Now, guys, I want to take a short break here at this point. We're going to take a little pause and continue to talk more in the second hour, second segment. And why don't we just kind of talk about the websites of where people can go to find out more about your individual work. John, let's begin with you then right away. And please give out your details and where people can read and watch your videos about the star map.
Well, if you head on over to CosmicGnostic.com, that website, you can pretty much find out about all of everything that I've been speaking about here. I have been developing new videos recently, going back to these parks, revisiting them, and adding even more detail to them. But there has been years of blogs and videos produced that centers around some of this work, and I also talk about and explore many other subjects over at CosmicGnostic.com. And also, I have a book project that I've been working on that centers around the star map of Charleston. It's called Mysterious Star Map, Charleston, South Carolina. And you can get a copy of it on my website. And that's basically it.
Excellent. Yeah, Mysterious Star Map. That's a really good book as well, by the way. I recommend everyone to check out the videos first if you want to see more about that, and CosmicGnostic.com will get you more. Dave, give us your website so people know where to go to read more about your stuff.
Yeah, it's called Beyond Knowledge, and the actual web address is www.beyond-knowledge.co.uk. I've basically put on there an extract from the article that I did for Court about a place called Aramamuru, which is a very special place on the side of Lake Titicaca, just a few yards away from Titicaca, about half a mile. It's a very interesting place, which is one of the sort of huacas that I was talked about before. Very interesting because it's got a sort of interdimensional doorway there, apparently. So I was just writing about that and its mythological and astrological associations there.
Oh, nice. Now, have you you do have some video clips and stuff like that on the website too? Is that something you're continuing to do and shoot some video when you're down there?
Yeah, I sort of visited Brian Forster last year when I was down in Paracas, and he's done a few short sort of videos. He goes around various sites in South America, and there's a couple of his on Aramamuru there, explaining about the connection with the sort of serpent, the earth serpent of the underworld, which is another common theme that occurs actually across every culture, virtually. You see it in Europe with the weaver, which is supposed to be, you know, in the underneath certain cathedrals like Chartres and Amiens and things like that. And there's the serpent of the underworld, which recurs across lots of different South American cultures, actually, part of the three worlds, the three Pashas. And Aramamuru is very much associated with that as well. Very interesting place.
Indeed, very good. Beyond-knowledge.co.uk. And then, Court, let's wrap up with you then. I want to know where listeners can read more, check your videos. You have a magazine, books. Give us the details.
Yeah, I've got my my latest book out, Axis Mundi, which does not include the Shugborough Hall information. But you can check me out at survivalcell.blogspot.com. And the True History Journal is for sale there. There's links there, and to buy my book as well. And I have 55 videos on YouTube on the Survival Cell channel covering a lot of the subjects we're talking about here.
Very good. Let's enjoy a tune, and we'll be back with more in the second hour. Thanks, guys.